Reverend Laura Cowton, advises that she is a lifelong Unitarian Universalist. Advises that she describes herself as a preacher's kid. Her mother was a Unitarian minister. Is from Winnipeg, although she has traveled far and wide, and most recently has been living in Switzerland. She is a relatively recent graduate of Meadville Lombard Seminary in Chicago. Advises that again when she was in Europe, had founded one or two fellowships there, as I understand, is currently stranded in Canada, awaiting the nod from U.S. authorities to take up her ministry in Fairfax, Virginia.
So I have another story for you. It's an old story about a Unitarian farmer. This is before we were Unitarian Universalists. This guy just identified as Unitarian. Farmer Brown, he bought an old abandoned farm out in the country, and the land was overgrown with weeds, and the farmhouse and the barn, they were falling apart. There were missing boards here and there, and the fence was kind of decrepit. And on his first day there, the local town preacher came out to welcome him to the community and give him a blessing and a prayer, saying, God bless your hands and the work that you're going to do to make this land bountiful and fertile. God bless you. And Farmer Brown tipped his hat in thanks, sent the preacher on his way. The preacher returned after a few months and found the farm and the land transformed. There was whitewash on brand new fence posts, and the barn was all repaired, and there were animals in perfect little pens, and there were beautiful corn rows growing green and budding, and everything was just well kept. And Farmer Brown comes up to the preacher comes up, and he just says to Farmer Brown, "This is amazing. Our prayers have been answered. Look at the work that God has wrought here on your land." "Well, yes, Reverend," said Farmer Brown, "but do remember how this land looked when it was in God's hands alone." So Unitarian Universalists, we know that it is by our hands that the work gets done, do we not? And that we cannot count on the miracles or prayers alone. They do help sometimes. And we accept responsibility for our lives and for our world. We are people of action and of justice, working to make our world a better place by living in a way that not only minimizes our environmental impact, but hopefully, just hopefully, can repair some of the damage that people have caused. This is how we live our faith, by doing good things. We sign petitions, and we make signs, and we march in protest. We build memorials. We buy responsibly produced products and use renewable resources when we can. We feel compelled to do something. But what? And is simply doing enough? And sometimes when we do, to try to fix, there are cats falling out of the sky. And we don't know what's going to happen next. So where is our responsibility really? One of our guiding principles is respect for the interdependent web of all existence, of which we are a part. And people sometimes forget that last line. We are part of that web. So this principle directs us to act for the environment on behalf of all living things, including ourselves. The humanist view puts responsibility and accountability purely on humanity for correcting the plight of the world and of its creatures. And humanist view does not trust the supernatural force to intervene and save us. It is by our hands that the work gets done. So eco-spirituality, that's the topic for today, asks us to look beyond our sense of justice and to connect even more deeply with nature on a personal and on a spiritual level. The principles of eco-spirituality are relatively simple. In order to resolve environmental issues, deep environmental issues that we're experiencing today, depletion of species and global warming and the overconsumption on our planet, humanity must examine and reassess our underlying attitudes and beliefs about the earth and our connection to the earth and our spiritual responsibilities to the earth. This is what eco-spirituality asks of us, to go deeper inside. So what does this actually look like? What is our spiritual responsibility to the planet? That's what we're exploring today. What does it look like in our daily lives? It sounds simple in principle, but what do we do? The stakes are increasingly high, as we know. We can all feel the effects of the changing planet. Rather than looking forward, the answer may lie with some of our UU ancestors. Well, specifically Unitarian again, this one. The transcendentalist Ralph Waldo Emerson, one of my favorite authors. In his essay, Nature, he reimagined the divine as something which he referred to as nature, with the N writ large. He described nature as a spiritual being that provides for humankind. And he believed humankind, in return, must care for nature. Emerson, he recommended that people find a way to be in good relationship with nature. As nature gives generously all that we need, humans must in return reciprocate and give nature what she needs. Reciprocity. That's an interesting idea. Anyone who has seen the sweeping organic buildings of the Unitarian architect Frank Lloyd Wright, I know we have some architectural aficionados in the room. Anyone who has seen those buildings would understand his words. Frank Lloyd Wright, he said, "I believe in God, only I spell it nature." Again, with a large N. He often brought aspects of nature into his buildings with use of light, natural light, and plants and shapes and water in the buildings. He had an intuitive relationship to the processes and cycles of the earth, creating spaces for people to live in harmony with nature. Some of his buildings look like grand tree houses, and you can really feel like you're sitting outside when you're inside. Wright has inspired a new generation of sustainable architecture that seeks to minimize negative environmental impacts of buildings while also complementing the surrounding landscape. Speaking of tree houses, anybody here have a tree house? Did you ever have a tree house as a child? Yeah. Who climbed trees? Yeah. The 2009 blockbuster movie Avatar was an adventure in ecological theology. Who saw Avatar? Who saw it more than once? For the rest of you, this is going to be a spoiler. Okay. So Avatar has overt political overtones that are all too familiar. There's a destructive military culture that invades the pristine planet of Pandora. to harvest its natural resources without thought to the consequences to the landscape, the resources, the planet, or the indigenous peoples. Does this sound familiar? The exploitation of the valuable mineral site on Pandora ended in a massacre of the peaceful tribe, the Navi tribe, and destruction of their ancestral home in a beautiful sacred tree. On Pandora, Awa is the guiding force and deity of the land and of the Navi people. And Awa acts to keep the ecosystem of Pandora in perfect equilibrium. Ecosystem, equilibrium. Roots. Everything on Pandora is linked to Awa, mystically and biologically, through pathways of energy. Energy and communication, pathways that meet at a giant willow tree, and its beautiful symbology in this movie. The Tree of Souls is the most sacred site on Pandora. And the natives of Pandora, they revere the beauty of creation as a system, an interconnected web. And they see themselves as part of that whole. Everything in balance, sharing back and forth. Since Avatar was produced in 2009, scientific research has proven that trees secretly talk to one another through a complex network of roots and fungus that scientists are calling the Wood Wide Web. Seriously, that's what they're calling it, the Wood Wide Web. And adult trees, so this is really cool, adult trees can share through their roots sugars and nutrients with younger trees to help them thrive. And sick trees or dying trees can send their nutrients back into the system to where it can be used. I think that's pretty amazing. They communicate with one another about their health. They send signals about danger. When there's a fire, when there's an infestation, they'll shut down and keep themselves apart from the web if they know that they are going to spread something dangerous. It's an incredible network, really sophisticated. And they warn each other by redirecting their resources, or help each other by redirecting their resources. It's a reciprocity. It's a community of communication. And it seems to be doing a better job at coexisting than humans, somehow. Following Emerson, there's another transcendentalist who I love to read, and maybe you do too, Henry David Thoreau. Any Thoreau fans in the room? Thoreau was captivated by trees, and they played a significant role in his artistic expression, in his creativity, in his philosophical thought, and even in his inner life as a spiritual person. He responded emotionally to trees, but Thoreau also understood them scientifically, as a naturalist. He reverenced trees as living incantations. He was a poet. Trees were wordless prayers, benedictions for the art of being. I invite you to find a tree today to reverence life and look at as the art of being. There's one out front here. Just pause and spend some time with the tree as a poem. Rachel Carson, who died in 1964, she was the pioneering marine biologist who wrote on scientific and spiritual bonds. She was one of the first environmentalists, and she brought spirituality and science together for us in ways that opened a lot of minds. Carson said, and I quote, "I believe natural beauty has a necessary place in the spiritual development of any individual or society. She said, "I believe that whenever we destroy beauty, or whenever we substitute something man-made and artificial for a natural feature of the earth, we have retarded some part of man's spiritual growth." In her lovely book, Braiding Sweetgrass, the botanist and indigenous wise woman, Robin Wall Kimmerer, she shares stories of earth-based wisdom through the lens of science and tradition. Following on Carson's work, when Kimmerer, she told her university advisor that she wanted to study botany, quote, "because I want to learn about why asters and goldenrods look so beautiful together." She wasn't taken very seriously. The university advisor replied, "That is not science." But she persisted. She said, "I'd like to learn why plants make medicines, why willows bend for baskets, and why strawberries are sweeter in the shade." "Yeah, also not science," he said. But she said, "I just wanted to know why. Why do they stand beside each other when they could grow alone? Einstein himself said that God doesn't play dice with the universe. Why," she asks, "is the world so beautiful?" She studied formulas and facts and figures and mechanical structures of hard science. She learned about evidence and logic. And after earning her PhD, Kimmerer met a Navajo woman who shared with her the ancient teachings. One by one, name by name, she told of the plants in her valley, where each one lived, when it bloomed, who it liked to live near, and all of its relationships, who ate it, who lined their nests with its fibers, and what kinds of medicines it offered. She spoke of beauty. Kimmerer then used her scientific knowledge and discovered there are special color receptors in our eyes. She learned about colors that are reciprocal pairs, meaning that they make together, they make one another even more vivid. Asters and goldenrods have known this for a very long time. Their striking contrast, when they grow together, makes them the most attractive target for bees in the whole meadow. Growing together, they receive more pollinator visits than anyone else, more than they would if they were growing alone. Standing side by side, they thrive together, and they're beautiful. Kimmerer writes, "That September pairing of purple and gold is lived reciprocity. Its wisdom is that the beauty of one is illuminated by the radiance of another. Science and art, matter and spirit, indigenous knowledge and Western science, can they be goldenrod and asters for one another? When I am in their presence," she says, "their beauty asks me for reciprocity, to be the complementary color, to make something beautiful in response to nature." The beauty of the earth asks us to make something beautiful in response. This is eco-spirituality. In Braiding Sweetgrass, Kimmerer, she circles towards a central argument that the awakening of a wider ecological consciousness requires the acknowledgement and celebration of our reciprocal relationship with the rest of the living world, the web of which we are a part. For only when we can hear the languages of other beings will we be capable of understanding the generosity of the earth and to learn to give our own gifts in return. Our spiritual response to the environmental crisis can bring us to understand ourselves as a part of divine oneness with nature writ large. Finding ourselves entwined with the web of life in a way that enriches all life. Let us be mindful. Let us make more rituals and ceremonies to celebrate the wonder of life and our interdependence with it. Let us tread more lightly and bring a renewed sense of purpose and spirituality to our environmental work with our hands and with our spirits. Let us find the sacred thread that weaves the essence of humanity into the tapestry of all creation. And then let us engage the world from this new awareness. We sang earlier, "Roots hold me close, wings set me free. Spirit of life, come to me, come to me." May it be so. Amen.